I mean, this is like the fourth episode. I'm basically a professional at this point. I should probably treat myself to a good room.
Yeah, like a sweet padded room.
Yeah, definitely. Episode 9. Which ones did we talk about last time?
So last time it was 4, 5, 6, and this time it'll be 7, 8, 9.
7, 8, 9.
But for us, what is 8, 9 are different than what they were a month ago.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you talked about like, should I do this one as like one big comic issue, or should I split it? Eight. But, I mean, 7, by the way, isn't really... There's not that much to say. It's short.
Yeah, it's baby. Just like... Yeah, you know, just, it's very Superman-y, but it's like, you know... Yeah.
It's ugly as sin. It's a funny chapter, but it's not a lot happens in it. I like the fact that some of the corns, I don't know if it comes across in the panel, but some of the corns popped. The white stuff is a little all over the place.
No, it comes across and it's really funny. I think on Webtoon, I might have cropped some of that out to get the fit on the angle on that one, right?
Yeah.
I did that one a little bit weird on Webtoon. I made those panels a bit strange, if I remember right. It's not quite the same.
Yeah, you cropped them vertically instead of horizontally.
But yeah, I think in the full version, you can see the popcorn. I was actually looking back over that because I'd forgotten that was in there, especially because I think I might have looked at an older version of the art recently. And you always layer in like good little jokes like that. And that stuck out to me when I was rereading that chapter, that like you made sure it was explicitly a cornfield. Like, this is not like some generic field that they're in.
Yeah, and that, again, I know we talked about like, where on earth are we? Is this place necessarily set in America or not? But I really think that wherever we're at in terms of Megaville, this farm is definitely in America. I mean, it's a corn farm. And also the way the mom talks, ugly as sin. It definitely tries to sell a pretty different type of Martha Kent. This,
Well, if it's corn,
I think she's my favorite.
Oh, she's weird. She's horrible.
Yeah. Oh, I love their... Oh, you know what? I probably shouldn't say. We'll meet them soon.
Next chapter, actually. Yeah, chapter 10.
Oh. Yeah. So I won't comment on them more than... I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that next one is a fun chapter. It's this whole... This 7, 8, 9 was fun for me because things are starting to me, feel like we're leaving that period where we have to just establish the background for everything, and now it's kind of like is building up to what I think of when I think of quintessentially these characters and their relationships with each other. So
absolutely.
That really gets a big push forward in the next chapter, and I'm in chapter 10, which I'm looking forward to that one.
I mean, chapter 9 is the first chapter where we actually have two of our characters in the same chapter, right?
Chapter 8 has them together in the chapter, but chapter 9 has them in the same place.
Yeah, I mean, because we see Hester fall in the background.
Yeah.
As Gloom's at his interview.
I almost split right up until the night before that, the release of our 9th chapter, where Hester goes to Megaville to fight Midnight. I almost split it into two, because I was like, man, it's a fucking long chapter. I don't know if I really feel like posting all these panels. Like, maybe I'll just post half of it. But the middle of the chapter is that scene where Gloom is doing his job interview. And I was like, I can't cut it off, because you got to see what happens before the job interview. You got to have the job interview, and then you got to see what happens after. And that, it's satisfying when it happens like that, you know. And I think for me, that's probably been my favorite chapter that I've posted yet.
I am so torn about this chapter overall, and in a lot of different ways. It could be one of my favorites. It's also so gratuitously violent and strange, and I didn't even know what to expect from our readers when this was posted. I thought, okay, we might lose subscribers because it has a different, because tonally so far, it hasn't been that violent. It's been focused on these weird characters. What will the reaction be when we post a chapter like this, when we show that, okay, it's also pretty brutal? I was reading a lot of Robert Kirkman's Invincible at the time when I drew this,
and those fights get pretty bloody, don't they?
Yeah, and they and shockingly so. They go from like humorous Spider-Man-esque type of violence to all of a sudden just drenching their characters in blood, much much worse than, I mean, Ryan Otley's amazing at that, but it also shocks you as a reader when it first happens in that book, which I guess was what I was going for. I was pretty heavily influenced by that, the whole contrast between not having a lot of violence and then having a lot of violence. And I'm still kind of like, ooh, that is, but then there are things like the blood is actually not just gratuitous. It actually fills a function when you think about it, because, so I'm jumping ahead. So at this point we're at when Hester's hit the pavement, she stands up and the bus slams her.
Yeah.
So two things happen. First, we needed a way of Hester getting out of the fight, but she's still being incapacitated.
Right.
And our solution is the bus dragging her off, right?
Right.
Plus, we also have all the fans rushing Midnight wanting autographs, which also sort of hinders him from continuing the fight. But what's interesting is the blood sort of tracks where she's at. We can see that she's being dragged by the bus. And it says a lot, but it also sort of sells the world, because when we scroll to it's like the fourth last panel, we can see that didn't really stop until the bus stopped. So yeah, the bus just kept going. You gotta keep that schedule, gotta be on time. It just kept going until it reached a bus stop. Like, what kind of city is this where a person is hit by the bus and it just, I mean, it's that kind of thing that it does.
Yeah.
It adds, it's a dark sense of humor, and it's stuff like that. Cause, and if you look at like panel 1, 2, 3, the fourth panel, you can see in the alleyway, it's full of garbage, like full, like no one's collected the garbage in months. And you start to think like, are they on strike? Like city sanitation, are they not working? Cause, and it's the same with the other alleyways. It's just like garbage bags, and it's nothing we explored. I'd like to go back in time and ask myself, like, did you sort of for yourself imagine that the garbage men were on strike? for no reason at all. Where was I? Oh yeah. So anyway, the violence isn't completely just gratuitous. It fills a pretty important function as well. Without saying it, it shows us that. Yeah, this isn't your normal city. People are pretty, and the people don't even react to the violence. They're just, oh, it's midnight. They don't, I mean, well, for starters, yeah, like they cringe for 2 seconds, and then they see their hero and just completely forget about what they just saw.
Yeah. I think that the blood, I was noticing that when I was getting ready to post this chapter. I was like, wow, Mills really made sure that we could follow this logical line, because that's nothing that I suggested you should draw. That was, that's all you making those choices when you're staring at that big ass panel on your computer screen. And you made sure that readers could follow that blood trail around the corner if they wanted to, and realize that at some point there's a puddle of blood that indicates that Esther slid off the front of the bus and then walked her way into the alley and then dug a hole into the ground and left through the sewers. And I thought that was really cool. I was just loving that. I've become a bit, like, I almost feel like I take it for granted that you're always going to make those good choices, you know? But to me, that was a really fun thing to go back through and see when I was reading it. And it did make me wonder a little bit about the nature of the city. But I also feel like the city becomes more and more an important part of what's happening to these characters, because as they begin to center around it, the weird mixture of indifference and like assumption that people make in the city is a lot of what makes these characters supervillains in a way, right? So like, you almost have to have this city where people like don't really care about the violence, or where they're more interested in something else, or, you know, and we see it more like, you know, what happens to Hester maybe four chapters from now or something like that, when she's living somewhere very different. That's a fun side of the city too.
I know exactly. Yes. And you're definitely right. This is sort of a weird city where the people who actually care about it are the villains, I guess. It's like, at least the bad guys care. In a way.
And, you know, I gotta say, unintentionally, and maybe this is just what I gravitate towards when I'm telling a story, you know, the two other things that have been set in this Megaville, in my mind, are the first Super Hater story, the one that we did together, whatever ago, a long time ago, and Cougar and Cub, that Daniel, Rosie, and I did. Yes. And those actually really fit in completely tonally with this version of Megaville, where there's violence happening and the heroes are kind of complicit in the collateral damage. And the villains actually seem to have a vested interest in wanting some kind of ownership or agency in the city. And I guess that's the dangerous cocktail.
Yes. And the heroes, they just, I guess they do their job. They're not that heavily invested in what they do. They just do it for the sake of doing it. So that was the thing I was worried about, Chapter 9, the fact that it was so violent. But the violence does feel it fills a purpose. It is not violence just for the sake of it being violent. But then it's weird in different ways. Like, we have, well, for starters, she jumps on, she's almost like skips stones across pigeons on her way to the building. One pops. That one was just for the sake of being violent, I guess. And then we have just a ton of... and then we have, like, the guy... when she hits the pavement, there's a guy who gets so surprised that his hat falls off. He's in the red car.
Yeah.
Which kind of looks like your old-timey type of cartoon. He even drives like I wouldn't be able to place it, but I guess like old 50s, maybe 60s type of car. That's interesting. I even added the dead pigeon to the ground. I haven't noticed it until now. A couple of them have actually hit the pavement.
I see it too. I didn't notice that either.
That's continuity though. I mean, that makes sense. There are just so many weird details that I keep noticing. Like, I like the fact that the woman interviewing Gloom has paused her Tetris game. She hasn't paused and it kind of looks like I hear. Yeah, she has a she's up there with her high school score. I get it. She probably. I was gonna say, what if she only has like 10 points? She might as well have turned it off. But no, she has a few points.
Yeah, she's doing pretty good there. It would seem because, I mean, she recently cleared the rows out and.
You're not going to drop that game just for, like, an interview.
Yeah, I mean, she's in the tens of thousands. I wouldn't. Yeah. You kidding me?
I don't know if that's
not a lot. Not if I worked in Night Court.
Tetris. Yeah. And then we have Kitty Camper Cookies, the truck in the background.
Oh, yeah, from our failed animation pitch. Yeah, maybe it's a good time to get into the failed animation pitch.
I was thinking so, too, when I noticed the truck. I thought we could probably... We could probably mention Kitty Cat.
Yeah, how about we do this? How about let's I don't want to get too deep into it yet because we haven't even said that the alien's name isn't even in the story that we've released yet. But maybe let's tease it. And then in one of the upcoming podcasts, maybe if we do, I haven't decided. I was thinking maybe I wouldn't take the hiatus that I have planned in our schedule right now to which is like, you know, basically taking off December for the webcomic.
All right.
But if I do, maybe we should do the failed animation pitch podcast then. If I end up.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Doing the hiatus. Because we just have so much content from it. I mean, when I was going through our archives, which I hilariously went through and downloaded everything from every email we ever sent to each other. To create these archives and then realize that you'd already sent me the folders like 3 years ago.
Oh yeah, I have everything like sorted out. Yeah,
you already sent everything. I felt real foolish afterwards. Yeah.
But I'm not sure I've saved everything actually. Sketches might have gotten lost over the years.
Yeah, there might be a couple things, which case I would have saved if I could. Although interestingly, I was going through Gmail emails from 8 years ago or whatever. 7 years ago. And some stuff just doesn't load anymore. So whatever images, whatever server your images were on,
it might just be
a few of them are dead now.
I could look that over. My Dropbox might be full.
No, it's not that. I mean,
I didn't send Dropbox links.
No.
Oh.
I mean, you did like once or twice we did that, but it's just. It's just the file in the email, you know, like embedded into the body of the email.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the older stuff, there's like a 2 or 3 month period where every image you sent me no longer shows up. But I wasn't in the habit of deleting the images from my replies at that time. So I was able to get a lot of stuff by going
into the
replies and saving it, which was really fun. I mean, that's all the stuff that you probably have. In your archives, if I were to go through and...
Yeah, for sure. I never throw anything away, and I back it up and stuff. It should be somewhere. Just let me know whatever email it was. I could probably look it up.
Oh, it's it's fine. I probably got it. But I just thought that was an interesting thing. That's something I haven't encountered before.
So we'll put a pin in Kitty Camper Cookies then.
Yeah, but at some point we'll tell you guys about our failed animation pitch, which was a lot of fun to make.
It was a lot of fun. You know what their slogan is? Their slogan is the best. It says so in the corner.
Yeah.
Guys, we need a slogan. The best.
Hey, you know.
I love that. Was that? Did we have that? Sorry, we were gonna put a pin in that. But yeah, I wanna go back. I just wanna go. I need to go back and look if we had that in the pitch as well. If that was their slogan or if that's something we added to the webcomic.
I don't know. I think you probably made it up for this panel. That's my guess.
Yeah, they need a slogan.
Yeah, just for chapter 9 here. But we have an interesting situation with these three chapters, 7, 8, and 9, where they, you know, we mentioned this if you listen to any of our previous episodes talking about how we made the Evil Life. The story was not created linearly, and it wasn't ordered. The panels weren't ordered the way that they are now, and in particular 7, 8, 9 are chapters that have been taken from different, well, they were made in some very different parts of the process, but they were also taken from other areas and kind of restructured to be in this sort of vague chronological order. But I remember going back to our old files that what is Chapter 7, where our alien arrives on Earth, that's that was actually initially just part of one continuous chapter of the home planet blowing up, going through space, landing on Earth. And our little vignette that begins Chapter 8 with Hester talking to Jerry about how he's helped heal her, that was originally connected directly to the end of the previous chapter where we saw Hester with the marmots. I think that was like Chapter 6 or something, the way that we have it now. And that just kind of flowed. It was just, you know, it was like, you know, a few weeks later, like a caption like that or something like that. But then we moved that around to kind of create a new structure. And then, as we kind of like mentioned briefly in early in this recording, what is Chapter 8 now? That was just two completely different things. But they were really short chapters. And I was like, well, why am I just going to post like four panels for 1 week? That doesn't seem to make any sense. And it all flowed pretty well together because it's all about Hester looking at Megaville from afar and Gloom experiencing Megaville up close. And, you know, it kind of goes into each other. But
I think it flows really well. We have them both in Part 8, and then we see them in the same scene just briefly in 9. It flows together pretty nicely. And it's one of those, oh, are they going to meet? Is this, it's pretty, they're so close in terms of vicinity, but nope, not yet.
And even the stuff with Gloom being at his job interview and sitting across from what's her name, Barbara Bartsky or whatever her name is. That was a very late addition. We just added that into the story for fun later. I don't know where that even came from, honestly.
And I can sort of tell by the style that it's a late one as well.
You can tell a little bit, just a tiny bit.
Because the style has evolved. It's the same with the interview scene as well. It's a pretty late one. I mean, the one where he's waiting in the reception room is also with the weirdos.
Oh, that collection of weirdos is so good.
So on webs, I like a guy who goes to the interview barefoot as well, like in his boxers.
Yeah, that guy just can't be bothered to like have like a wig toupee situation that makes sense. He just doesn't care.
I think it's a tinfoil hat actually. The guy with the...
Wait, are you saying that's not supposed to be like a wig that he's wearing?
It's really hard to sell like metal, but I think it's supposed to be like a tinfoil hat crumpled up. I think it could be a weird wig, but the barefoot guy.
Yeah, I could see it being tinfoil. Yeah. I misread it as like a bad wig.
It could be like a bad wig. Doesn't it's funny either way. I think the barefoot guy must have a ton of confidence, like to go in. He seems a little bit too comfortable based on his foot mannerisms.
You know what? It's just a pair of feet. We should just put this guy in the story later, and we'll just say that.
That's the guy. That's
we'll
the
pretend that some other guy is the barefoot guy.
I'm a little bit. You're always disappointed when something's cropped. I like them all so much. There's a woman to the left that you can't see on Webtoons.
Sweating. I'm looking at it on my website. She's there.
Yeah. She's sweating bullets. But tries to keep she tries to put on a brave face, smiling like a crazy person. That panel in particular.
That's a good one. She's very professional, you know, even though she's very awkward.
Yeah. I mean, she's. I think the one that's, even though she's sweating bullets, probably the most normal. Out of the bunch. I also like the elevator scene with Bert and the other guys. I think it's a B. It could be Gert. You don't know, but it's probably Bert.
I like Gert. That's good.
That would have been better if it actually was Gert, but we can't really tell. So you made the right choice cropping that panel on Webtoons, but I think it's at its best when you see the full panel of the elevator scene and you can read.
That was the such different a choice.
Oh, I get it. I would, but I think I would have made the same choice because it's just a bunch of ridiculous names of all the floors.
No, I love the elevator listings on that floor. Yeah, we're talking about in Chapter 8.
Yeah, Chapter 8.
When Gloom is on an elevator for just one panel. And if you read the post on my website, you may have already seen the list of floors because I wanted to spotlight it, knowing that people on Webtoon wouldn't be able to see it.
I saw that, and I really appreciate the fact that...
Hey, I'm just saying, you sneak some good jokes in there, so we gotta make sure that people are seeing these jokes.
I'm not gonna give them away. If people want to read them, that's what they're there for. But it also sort of sells this weird world that they're in. Like, going back to that idea of what kind of place is Megaville, really?
I mean, it's a mess. It's a total wreck.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I guess indicates that it definitely is America, then.
Or people in general, I think.
Because
you'll find that people can get easily jaded especially in a bigger city where nothing's really personal. A person you might meet one day, you probably won't see ever again. Like, you don't really have to form relationships with people you randomly meet on the street, unlike cities where pretty much everyone knows everyone, and there are almost always consequences to your behavior. So what I liked about 8 is that one was way later, but I realized there needs to be continuity as Gloom enters the building. So the same people who are outside when Hester arrives can also be seen in one of the panels, the first one with Gloom.
That's right.
And they're comparing Night Corp tattoos. They both have tattoos on their arms. You want to tell people who the guy on the right is?
Well, yeah. I mean, this comic was made so long ago that Nils drew me into the comic, but I don't even look like that anymore.
No, you have a different style. You used to have you used to have long hair.
Yeah, I used to have long hair, and I always wore a bandana around my forehead.
And it's the opposite.
Looked just like me when you drew it.
You're even the guy taking the picture of the guy, the couple with the camera.
I actually meant to post some tweets about that. I'll post it. Maybe I'll post it along with the podcast. That was my outdated cameo. But yeah, I loved it, and I was very flattered when you drew it in there. But
you know what's kind of funny is that when I drew it, I do make an appearance myself. I think I'm in line at a restaurant.
Yes, much later.
Just like playing with my phone.
Yes, 6 months from now.
And I have short hair. Now I have long hair, and I don't at all. I don't look like that at all. So it's the same thing, but in reverse. I felt who should be the biggest Midnight, most hardcore Midnight fan, if not Nick Marino, and
appreciate
with the tattoo and everything.
Maybe I'll have to get that tattoo now, just to actually. I got a good open spot for it on the shoulder. So.
Oh yeah, make it a thing.
Add that one
soon. Oh, you know what? We haven't addressed the fact that this is the first time we see Hester in her first superhero or supervillain outfit.
Oh, yeah. You know, she gets the... I think we spoke about it maybe on one of our previous episodes. She gets the evolving costume.
Mm-hmm.
And man, when I was downloading stuff from our old emails, I was really seeing those evolving costumes.
Yeah, we had a bunch of different takes on what it could look like. And this was, I think, initially meant as a flashback. So we sort of went back and tried to imagine what her first costume might have looked like.
And I love this costume. I love how homemade it is. It looks like the Marmots could have made it for her, honestly.
It's a little kind of like Selena Kyle, Catwoman.
Yeah, it really is.
With all of the stitchings and everything really visible. what had us a bit worried, I think, was when Squirrel Girl came out, which was later than our comic. Like, our comic is older than Squirrel Girl. But still, will people think we've copied Squirrel Girl now?
Well, I mean, okay, look.
Was sort of like something we worried a bit.
I mean, Squirrel Girl, she was around for years, right?
Oh, well, that's true. The popularity.
I think just about everybody forgot about her until, what, maybe Bendis wrote her in as, like, the nanny in New Avengers or something, right? Isn't that what it was?
Something like that.
Or maybe it was when they did the... When they relaunched Great Lakes Avengers, she was in it. Maybe that's when they brought her back. I think Dan Slott and... who's the artist on that? I can't remember who drew it. They did a Great Lakes Avengers miniseries in maybe 2012 or something like that. And Squirrel Girl, I think, was in that one. So, I mean, maybe it was one of those things, but yeah. It was right around that 2012, 2013-ish time that that I think Squirrel Girl started to kind of get some renewed interest.
I'm looking at it now, and it kind of makes sense for it to be around the New Avengers time, as you said. I think that might be it.
I think she got to babysit Danny Cage.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's this really weird joke that I think Bendis had written into one of the comics that, like, Wolverine had slept with her, but people were just like, what?
Huh? Okay.
And then I feel like there was a lot of online conversation around it around that time, because that was also around the same time that she was going to get her own book or something.
Yes, and that's where she really, like, hit her stride and got really popular. And it's right after New Avengers that she gets the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl
book. I haven't read the book, but it looks really good.
Yeah, I haven't read it either. I sort of stopped reading a lot of Marvel books around that time, so I sort of dropped out of that. I read a few Marvel books still, but not a lot. We were kind of worried that the style of Squirrel Girl would be too similar to Hester's. I mean, okay, to be fair, we only use her suit for a little while, but still.
Yeah, and I think that this the squirreliest iteration of it is kaput. It's done now anyway.
She doesn't look like that anymore.
She never really puts it back together in quite the same way again. Right? Does she ever really?
But the color palette is still...
Oh, yeah, the palette stays. Yeah. But she basically just keeps on whatever tattered...
Yeah.
...costume she has on at the end of Chapter 9, I think, for the next couple of times that we see her. I honestly lose track when I think about it in my head. It's there on my computer somewhere. But yeah, but to me, you know, she is kind of like, maybe I was thinking of a Squirrel Girl type of thing at some point with her, but I don't really, probably not. I mean, I feel like that would have been really, I would have been really on the edge with that, like, guessing that or taking some influence from Squirrel Girl with that one, because that just wasn't really something that I was on my radar very much. But definitely the Selina Kyle Catwoman type vibe was. I always thought of her as kind of like...
It really needed to sell, like, that homemade feel.
Yeah. And the Selina Kyle Catwoman in particular that's in Batman Returns, I feel like does have some commonalities with our...
Yeah, like an anti-hero type of...
Yeah. And very much sort of like her own inquisitive nature sort of gets her into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Or causes her to be in a situation where people see her as a supervillain. I think that's definitely
she's sort of thrown into a situation where she has... no other option than to become a villain. Like, she tries to be good at first.
Yeah. She never stops trying to be good.
Didn't we conceptually discuss when we made Hester? Didn't we sort of go for that as well? Like, we wanted our version of Catwoman.
I'm sure we did, but I...
Bust and Marmot. I think that was the basis for her
it
character.
Must have like, been. It must have been. Because, yeah, because...
The alien has the like, Superman parallel. She right. has... Oh, we haven't told people who Gloom was, who was the basis for Gloom.
But yet. It must have been Dr. Doom, right?
It was. It was. He was way more... Like, the original concept for him was a bit more regal and Europeanly regal.
Yeah.
I guess. Before we went for the whole Monacqua Islandy vibe for him instead. Like, his initial was just like a typical, like, iron armor kind of...
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely evolved a lot. I think we just thought, what if he was just like a loser Dr. Doom?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it became something... I mean, yeah, there are obviously echoes of it there, but it definitely became something different. And I like where it's... I like where it's ended up.
Yeah, me too. And I think what happened was... I think when we wanted to introduce magic to it was part of where we started breaking off the character from his original source of inspiration, when we felt like, okay, we need something else to this character. He can't just be this evil... Dr. Doom reject. He needs to be more. But we kept the name, though, because we were so attached to him being called Gloom. It sounds like the word Gloom, but it could also mean something else in his language. It's not his name isn't actually Gloom. It doesn't actually mean the word Gloom, but it's something else. It just
We used to have a joke that he had a totally different name, but he chose Gloom.
Oh yeah, but then
scrapped it because you know what? There's only one thing. At least as we've established right now, there's only one thing that's ever like, if you would say in his language, or we never even really broached the subject, and it's just the name of the country. That's it. He has his own sayings, but they're in, like a conversational English when you read them. So it doesn't necessarily translate. And his parents, the king and queen, they're just the king and queen. We kept that pretty simple.
Yep.
So, maybe, what we've discussed, what we might do beyond what we've already completed, maybe we would find out some more about Monacqua and some other words from there. I don't even know.
It sounds... I would love to learn more names and words from their language. I think Monacqua sounds like a brand of exotic, like exclusive water, bottled water or something like that.
You know what?
Monacqua.
It does really sound like that.
Maybe that sounds like that.
Maybe that's where that country made its wealth. I don't know.
Oh yeah. The like their main export is bottled water, Monacqua water.
Yeah. Quick, go back in and add water bottles.
So I know I'm sort of jumping back and forth, but it's sort of as I'm scrolling and realizing things that I want to mention. One of my favorite things with the script, the Evil Life in general, is I'm giving one thing away by saying this, but it's not a big thing. We have three scenes with Hester where she's looking through binoculars.
Yep.
In this story.
Yeah, that's all script. We did a good job with that, didn't we?
And this is all script. By the way, it's not, and these are not my choices. And I absolutely love the fact that you added this to the story.
It's kind of an accident though, because Hester's story was originally the way we designed it. It was just going to all be read as one thing. So the binocular motif wasn't initially going to be spread out between the beginning, middle, and end of our story. But now every it has, time, and it works.
Yes, but it's also coincidental or not. It's really great in terms of storytelling because every time she uses her binoculars, it's at a monumental moment in her development.
Yeah. That's true.
It's a big moment for her, and it's also sort of sells the calm before the storm. She looks at what's about to happen before it happens, and you deliberately asked me to use the same perspectives.
That's true.
In every scene as well, like just like the last time, we see her looking through her binoculars, and then we see what she's seeing through the binoculars, and then something happens. And the fact that we have these three scenes, as you said, beginning, middle, and end, also really, it more or less just highlights these important moments in her. None of the other characters have that. She, in terms of storytelling, I think hers might be the best.
I think it is. I mean, and just like, this is almost like her story with the other characters as supporting characters in a way, because she gets so much more development and panel time than everybody else.
So far, only bad things have happened whenever she's looked through her binoculars, but fingers crossed for the third time, you know.
I'm hoping something good happens.
Yeah. We'll see.
Maybe.
Maybe. We'll see.
I don't know. Hmm. It might just be open to interpretation, just how good it is.
I guess that's true for the first one as well. I mean, being bitten by a radioactive marmot could be a good thing. She got superpowers out of it.
Would you be into that? Is that
no?
Like
no, like? No. I'm good. Powers free. Is the way I'd go. But for some people, Hester maybe. She kind of embraces it, and I think we haven't talked that much about chapter 8, the first part of chapter 8, where she trains Karate Kid style.
Yeah.
That was all you again. Like, I want a scene where the marmot and Hester train like they do in Karate Kid.
I really love Karate Kid 3, and there's this training sequence when Daniel recognizes, even though he didn't want to fight in the tournament, that if he doesn't, these guys are going to destroy the bonsai shop that him and Mr. Miyagi have set up together. So he embraces the challenge of training to go back and fight in the All Valley tournament again. And they have this really extravagant training scene set to classical music, but like not like your average film score. Like, this sounds more like you're listening to like a, you know, I don't know the words for classical music well, but like a very rousing piece, let's say.
Yeah.
And there's, wherever they filmed it, it's gorgeous. I mean, I assume it's probably somewhere not too far from where I am right now, along the coastline, maybe up towards the end of Malibu or in Ventura or something like that. Oxnard or something, and they do this great shot where they zoom out, and it's trying to kind of like imitate the crane scene from the first Karate Kid, which you can't imitate. They just got lucky with that.
Yeah.
And but this one, it's them doing this kata where they're basically like doing these sort of their hands turn over as they do the movements, you know, like kind of advancing forward, taking steps, turning their hands. And in my mind, I see that image all the time when I think about a training montage. And I just thought, hey, if I was going to say, why don't we do a training montage? I just thought, why not suggest this is a montage that I love. Maybe you'll like to draw something like this.
And it's such a different break from the tone of the story as well. Like, it's soulful. And all of a sudden, we just switch tones. Because why not? I love it. Had you asked me, like, what's a good training montage? Like, what do you think of when you think of a training montage? I'd probably just, hands down, Rocky IV.
Yeah, that's true. That is a
like it's just like one long training montage musical type of movie, but this is so much better. Because it would just be, had we used like a Rocky IV type of training montage, like Hester running up hills, carrying logs, like just brute force, it would have just been, I think, too much ridiculousness. This is, in a sense, having a marmot doing a kata is ridiculous enough.
That is ridiculous enough.
But I went all in and just tried to make it as serious as possible.
No, man, you did so good. I love the lighting you chose and everything. For me, what I I think what I was intending, if I can get into the headspace I was in, whatever, 6 years ago, mm-hmm. whenever we did that page, I was thinking the joke here would be that there was this huge thing that they, this huge adventure they went on emotionally, spiritually together, and we're just going to see one panel of it, and we're not going to have any idea what it really was, and she'll just say something like, "You healed me," and that'd be it, you know?
Oh, yeah, and she said the second panel, like, "Yes, let's go. I'm going to go." So they're determined and everything.
Yeah, man.
So great. Yeah.
Yeah, when we do the cinematic adaptation, we'll flesh out the montage, I guess.
Oh, definitely. That'll be like a 15-minute scene. Like people
will have. Do you remember that when we did in our failed animation pitch? I think I think the big scene was a montage, and they hated that.
Was it?
I feel like it was. Yeah, because remember.
I remember the.
I was going back through my files. I even wrote a song for it. And I recorded a really bad demo of me singing the song.
I remember the song, but I forgot. You know, I remember the thing I remember the best is I think the office scenes from that story.
Oh yeah, those were good. And very similar to the office scenes we might get to see in the webcomic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a big, I guess the middle, maybe not the focal point or anything, but the middle of it was this long montage, like this 30-second montage set over this song about Kitty Camper Cookies. What happened to them? And I remember us doing that scene, and I remember, stuff. So, yeah, I gotta say, I feel like all in all, very successful 3 chapters we had here.
Definitely. And I think we covered them pretty much in detail as well.
I would like to think so. I'm excited for what comes next.
Oh, yeah, me too. Me too. I mean, it's the one with the baby alien. And I've been looking forward to that chapter for a while now.
This is a good one. And you get that. Yeah. You do so many different styles in this next chapter.
I think it's the one of those where I drew one part of the chapter pretty early and then one way later.
But it works. It works because it covers a lot of time. So, well, maybe. I don't know how long it covers. We'll talk about that on the next podcast.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I think we're done. Yeah. Good job. Nicely done, sir.
Good job, you.
Yeah.